Welcome. You've brought us a really fascinating piece to look at today. A sermon that tackles one of the biggest human questions there is, what is the real, the unshakable source of joy in our lives?
It's an incredibly focused piece. The sermon kicks off with a pretty striking assertion. It says, you know, we all chase after things we need, money, security, success. But the foundational element, the one thing that makes life feel meaningful, is just joy.
And it sets the stakes really high right from the get-go. The argument is that if that joy isn't there, then every other achievement, even, you know, spectacular success, it just loses its meaning. So, okay, let's unpack this a bit. What kind of joy are we even talking about here? And why does the sermon claim the world's version of it is, well, always a failure?
That's the mission, really. We're here to analyze the sermon's claim that what we usually call happiness is inherently temporary. It's fragile. It depends on what's going on around us. So our goal is to trace the sermon's argument for you all the way from this idea of human emptiness to its proposed solution, the birth of Jesus, which is announced as the good news of great joy for everyone.
Let's start with that search for joy, because we're all in it. But this sermon is, well, it's deeply skeptical of how we go about it. It argues that even if you get everything you think you want, the career, the money, it all falls apart if that deep foundational joy is missing.
That's right. The sermon points to a paradox that I think we all kind of get intuitively. The problem isn't getting good things. It's the expectation that those things will deliver some kind of lasting internal happiness.
Yeah.
And the sermon says people know money can't buy joy, but they keep trying anyway. It argues that worldly pleasure gives you a temporary rush, sure, but it's always followed by a longer emptiness and pain.
It's the emotional hangover. You get the thing, you get that high, and then you're left feeling more empty than when you started. A vicious cycle.
Exactly. And the sermon even makes a literary connection here. It brings up C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy.
Yeah.
Lewis talked about this deep, almost painful longing he felt his whole life. A yearning that no worldly pleasure, no success could ever satisfy. And the sermon uses that to make its point. Humans just can't generate eternal, truly stable satisfaction on their own. It has to come from somewhere else.
So if we can't make it ourselves, the joy must come from, well, outside the system we're in.
And that's the pivot. That's where the sermon immediately shifts the definition of joy. When the angels announce the birth of Christ, they call it the good news of great joy.
Right.
What's fascinating is how specific that language is. The sermon is arguing this is a joy that's qualitatively different from just a good feeling. It's not about your team winning or having a nice day. This is something that fundamentally changes your entire existence.
Okay, so if the problem is that we keep trying to fill an internal void with external things, this solution has to target the void itself. But the sermon is very methodical. Before it gets to the joy, it first talks about what it sees as the one thing that blocks our access to it.
And that moves us to the core theological argument.
Yeah.
The sermon traces all human misfortune, suffering, and especially the absence of joy back to one single root cause, sin.
That is a huge claim. Why? I mean, how does the sermon argue that sin is the great thief of joy?
The answer it gives is that sin acts like this crushing psychological weight. Mm. It's described as a burden that heavily presses down on our soul.
Okay.
The guilt, the shame. It argues all of that just strips away our peace and our confidence. And if you don't have peace, you can't have real lasting joy. It's presented as a structural barrier.
The sermon makes that feeling so visceral, too.
Yeah.
It brings up the experience of the psalmist from Psalm 32 and describes this intense suffering when sin isn't dealt with. It talks about bones wasting away, constant groaning. It makes it sound like a physical illness.
That's a key detail because the sermon is hammering home the systemic nature of the problem. It argues the power of sin is so strong it actually makes us slaves. And here's the critical point. Because it's a deep systemic bondage, the sermon concludes that no amount of self-help or trying harder can break those chains.
You can't fix it yourself.
You can't. You can't find real joy if you can't solve the sin problem.
So if the problem is universal and our own efforts are, you know, completely useless, this raises the obvious question. If it's an insurmountable slavery, what is the only solution the sermon presents?
The sermon gives one and only one answer, Jesus Christ. He alone, according to this argument, can solve the problem of human sin and offer freedom. And that's why the birth is called great joy, because it contains the joy of sin forgiveness. That's the essential piece.
That brings us right to the core of the next section, then, this idea of an incomparable gift. We're back to that angel's message, which says, "Do not be afraid. Behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which shall be for all people." It's this huge universal promise.
Yes, and the sermon frames salvation as this supreme, unearned gift from God. It's received through Jesus, who came to bear the consequences of that spiritual debt, that heavy burden we just talked about. The sermon claims that his death on the cross forgives all sins, past, present, and future, and leads to eternal reconciliation. That's why the joy is great. It's permanent. It deals with the root cause.
The sermon makes this comparison that's really crucial for understanding the argument. This joy of salvation is presented as something completely incomparable to any other joy the world has to offer. It's the permanent foundation versus those temporary fixes. But how do we really grasp that idea?
To give that claim real weight, the sermon uses the example of King David. Here was a man who had everything the world considers success. Immense wealth, absolute power, fame, military victories, everything.
Yeah, it all.
Literally everything. And yet, after his great moral failure, when he was completely broken, what did he desperately pray for? Not for his kingdom, not for his wealth. He prayed for God to restore to him the joy of salvation.
Wow. That is staggering, isn't it? A king with everything would trade it all just for that one thing. That really hammers home the sermon's central argument.
And if you connect this to the bigger picture, the sermon uses David's plea to prove that worldly luxury is totally irrelevant when that internal joy of being redeemed is gone. Salvation, it argues, changes us from the inside out. It grants a life and a freedom that no earthly status could ever touch. The joy is incomparable because it doesn't just manage the problem. It gets rid of the burden that was stealing your peace in the first place.
That sounds incredible, this permanent internal peace. But if it's truly the greatest joy, it can't be something you just keep to yourself, right?
Yeah.
It has to have some kind of external expression.
Precisely. And that leads us to the final and maybe the most practical part of the sermon. It insists this joy is not a private treasure. It's meant to flow outward, towards our neighbors, and specifically into our broken relationships.
So the internal change leads directly to external action. How does the sermon describe what that looks like in someone's behavior?
It argues that a person who truly experiences this good news will have a broader, more compassionate heart. They're transformed into someone who can embrace others. And this isn't just about avoiding fights. The joy actively drives them to enter into difficult, messy situations to create peace, to be an agent of reconciliation.
And this act as peacemaking is defined by the sermon through a specific scriptural link, right? It's moving from a personal feeling to a kind of mission statement.
It is. It cites Jesus' statement, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God." The joy you receive, the sermon explains, transforms you into a peacemaker because when you've been forgiven of the heaviest debt imaginable, you can now extend that forgiveness to others.
That makes perfect sense. The depth of the peace you receive determines your ability to extend peace to others.
Well,
so what does this peacemaking look like in the sermon's final wrap-up?
To synthesize the conclusion, the true completion of this great joy is using our very lives as instruments of peace in the world. This outward flow is meant to show up in practical ways, sowing love where there is hatred, forgiveness where there is conflict, and hope where there is despair. It's the ultimate social application of the core message. True joy creates peacemakers.
So to summarize for you, we've analyzed the pathway laid out in this profound sermon. It defined joy as the essential component of life. It identified sin as the crushing barrier that steals our peace. And then it presented salvation through Jesus as the unique source of an eternal, incomparable joy.
Right. The sermon provides a really clear, logical structure for you to consider. First, recognize the insufficiency of worldly joy. Second, acknowledge the universal problem of sin. Third, accept the gift of salvation that deals with that problem. And finally, live out that resulting joy by actively seeking peace with others.
It's a complete system, isn't it? It moves from recognizing an internal need all the way out to transformative action in the world. Joy isn't the destination, it's the engine.
And that's the crucial takeaway. The sermon concludes that the experience of true joy is what drives us to become peacemakers. This suggests that the depth of our inner peace is directly proportional to our ability to constructively engage with and heal the broken relationships around us. That's the ultimate test of the sermon's claim.
So we'll leave you with a final thought to carry forward from this analysis. If the greatest joy, according to this sermon, lies in restoring what is broken and actively extending forgiveness, which single relationship in your life right now might be waiting for you to demonstrate this kind of peace and reconciliation?